Eventfire Solutions is proud to support Extended. You can find us at eventfiresolutions.co.uk. Enjoy the programme.
I can understand why people could consider that to be quite disconcerting, because essentially what you're trying to do is fly into the sea and hope that an aircraft carrier gets in the way. There was an intense rivalry that bubbled over, and still does, between communities in military aviation. But that doesn't mean you wouldn't have fought like caged cats for each other if we'd ever had to go into battle together. So it's any wonder we're competitive. But at the end of the day, we're all on the same team.
Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Hello and welcome to Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Hello, I'm Peter Johnson. Thank you for joining us today. And today, alongside me is Ellie Carter. Ellie, how are you?
I'm really good. It's great to finally be back recording.
And you've been really busy. You've been doing some flying.
Yeah, I've been up to loads of flying. I've been filming for the BBC. I'm not allowed to say much about it yet, but it involves a World War I aircraft. So I've been flying Tiger Moths around to try and get used to them, and loads of cub flying and a bit of aerobatics. So I've really been doing loads and loads of stuff and flying to some really cool places. It's been really great.
Wow. And you were at Coventry. You got to see Fright Night.
Yeah, I did. That was amazing. What they're doing is incredible, and the aircraft is just beautiful, to be fair. The workmanship that's going into it is incredible. It's going to be a wonderful aircraft to fly.
And Tim Robinson is also with us.
I'm very well, thank you. Yep, good to be back.
And Tim, what's been going on in your aviation world?
Well, we're now getting back into the fall lecture and events season at the Society. So coming up, there is the Careers Fair coming up, which is always good. We've got some great lectures and conferences around the branches. So look out for those.
And Tim, you've brought along a guest for us today.
Yes, I certainly have. So I've been wanting to get this chap on for a while. So absolutely stoked this episode to welcome Paul Tremmeling, former Royal Navy Fleet Air Arm Harrier pilot, whose book Harrier, How to Be a Fighter Pilot, was published early this year. I think it's no exaggeration. It's become an instant classic overnight. It's honest, raw, and extremely funny in places. It's a true 100% no-holds-barred fighter pilot account of flying combat aircraft. It's really like eavesdropping on crew room banter. Paul, massive welcome to Extended.
Thank you very much for having me. Really glad to be here.
Thrilled to have you on the show. As I say, this is one of my favourite reads this year, and I've been annoying people by reading out some of your footnotes. Let's start your background. What inspired you into flying in the first place? Where did you catch the bug?
I caught the bug basically because a bit of a no-brainer in that it's sort of what Dad did. I grew up living on the periphery of naval air stations, so was able to see the aircraft, mainly helicopters, back in the sort of late 70s, early 80s, down at Coldrose and Yeovilton. And that was it, really. I mean, I'm not sure I mentioned it in the book, but my mum still tells people that she only managed to convince me to get to the tea table if she said that the air crew were eating, et cetera, et cetera. So I was devoted from a very, very early age to.
What was your pilot training career path? To get into a fast jet.
So largely. Traditional, but with one sort of untraditional bit in that I applied for a Royal Naval Flying Scholarship when I was at school, so got to go and fly 30 hours, I think it was, in Cessnas down at Cardinham Airfield in Cornwall before I went away to to university. At university, despite being sponsored by the Royal Navy, I joined the University Air Squadron and flew in Bulldogs. Then joined flying training. And the only abnormality with my flying training was that after elementary, in a decision, Tim, that I'm still not entirely balanced with, it was judged that I should go to rotary wing training. So I actually did the Shawbury course before being reselected back into the fixed wing stream. And then so I flew at Tucano from Linton-on-Ouse, Hawk out of Valley, and then went to 899 to learn the Sea Harrier. So ordinarily, people wouldn't have done that. If you were selected to go rotary, you'd have then gone to a frontline rotary type and then done a formal crossover later on. But so I was slightly abnormal in that regard.
Do you think the rotary kind of experience gave you a little bit of an edge in kind of mastering the Harrier later then?
Not probably not the Harrier. I think what it probably did, though, was just give me an extra 6 months of awareness and airmanship, etc. So particularly the start of the Linton course, where folk are trying to get up to speed with the Tucano. So, you know, 240 knots instead of 120 that you might be used to in a lighter aircraft. If you're used to helicopter flying, which by its nature is a lot lower, maybe it's harder to keep a bit of situational awareness going. It probably helped in those initial stages. I think I'd probably forgotten most of it by the time I got to 899 and got to hover the Harrier for the first time.
So all of this is really sort of detailed in your book, and then it kind of goes on from there. But so the idea for Harrier, how to be a fighter pilot, you know, what made you write it in the first place?
It's really an answer to what happens every time you get aircrew anywhere near a bar or beer, Tim, in so much as we all just start telling stories. Do you remember the day that we bombed the wrong island, sank the wrong ship, ran out of fuel, got lost in that thunderstorm? All the good stories obviously being slightly calamitous. About halfway through the evening, someone will invariably say, we ought to write these down. And that's actually, there's a rotary wing book called Scram, which is exactly the same. Harry, who wrote that, he notes it, that someone should eventually write it down. But there's this almost unwritten rule that no one's ever going to. But I was lucky that I went away with the French in 2010. So I was on their aircraft carrier for 4 months, October through Christmas into January. And I just had time on my hands. So I thought, well, you know what, bit of release. You can't spend 24 hours a day on the running machine or doing your briefings and all the other stuff. I'm just going to start tapping away. So that's how it started. So it was never meant to be a book as such. It was just a compendium of dits that I committed to something other than my own memory, if that makes sense.
Were there any dits that didn't make it into the book? Were there any you had to kind of cut out?
There were a couple that you mentioned earlier, the crew room side of things. There were a couple that were maybe a bit too exposing or a bit too unrelated to aviation. And there was one page that I think was pretty much a tantrum as a result of the Harrier going out of service. And I thought, Tim, you know what, that's not going to serve anyone if I release that, because that's the anger of the time speaking as opposed to any sort of deliberate and conscious thought. So those two probably didn't make the grade. And then there was the notion, of course, that because I had written a bunch of standalone stories, there was an awful lot of repetition in them. So you don't need to have to explain to you every single story how a radar works, for example, or how flying training was, etc., etc. So there was a significant sort of editing task to get from the amount of words we had, which I think started or grew to somewhere in the 140,000 arena, to hack that down to 90,000 for a book, you know, slack handfuls.
So, I mean, one of the things that I really enjoyed about the book is the level of detail in there and you know, like what's it like being in the cockpit and the kind of procedures and one of the things that, you know, stands out obviously is you flying the FA2, you know, the Shah Sea Harrier FA2 version, and you know how potent it was as kind of like an air defender. What made it such a deadly machine? Because you know, some people say, you know, great radar, good missiles, but it's subsonic, can't run away, kind of a 50s airframe.
Yeah, well, and of course they'd be right, Tim. they'd be absolutely spot on. But at the time of the FA2, we were just getting into the new concept of air-to-air weaponry, which was essentially one of using data links and updating tracks using the radar. What did that mean? It meant that most people were used to knowing they were in trouble if they got illuminated and something, for example, a Sparrow missile was on its way, and therefore you would react to that. So because we were essentially the new kid on the block and people weren't used to having to defend against a low-powered radar that was still able to guide a weapon onto you, oh, and by the way, from a bit further than you might have thought, then that's probably why it was so successful in early exercises. But yeah, you know, those stones that you threw, very, very accurate. It was only a 50s design. That the FA2 didn't benefit from any of the upgrades, so aerodynamic or power upgrades that other Harriers did. So those were things that you had to cope with from a tactical point of view.
And viffing, did you ever, I mean, that was a favourite thing that people like to sort of say about the, you know, the sort of Sea Harrier and kind of Harriers in dogfights. Did you ever use that in mock dogfights?
Yes. So, Tim, viffing, a little bit misunderstood, because, you know, you don't get anything for free. The notion that you might be able to move the nose a bit more will be given to you, but of course you're going to lose airspeed. So biffing might get you a small advantage quickly, followed by probably a massive disadvantage and sometimes even a departure from controlled flight, which could be anything from just not really being able to control the nose to an absolutely hellacious tumble through space. So yes was the simple answer, but what tended to happen was it was essentially a cycle whereby you would use viff a little bit guardedly, you'd be a little bit timid about it, or at least I would. And then one day you go, you know what, if I could just move the nose right now, this guy's mine. And so you'd reef in a whole load of nozzle, you'd get a sidewinder lock on someone using the rest of the integrated weapon system, which was great because we could throw shots well off boresight with the radar assisting the weapon. And all of a sudden you're now into a situation where you're very confident with viff. And that might, on occasion, lead you to be overconfident. And before long, you know, you're tumbling through space again, going, I really wish I hadn't done that. I'm not touching that nozzle lever again for 3 months. And so it was a sort of cycle whereby you went from being timid to confident to overconfident to, you know what, that's a silly idea.
So another highlight of the book, and it's a difficult book to talk about because there's so many good bits in it. I don't want to ruin it for our listeners. I want people to actually read it themselves. But you had some interesting adventures at Red Flag, put it this way. Simulated guns kills on prowlers, which presumably doesn't happen very often. And an interesting episode with a control lock, which saw you heading towards Area 51 and a Janet flight. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so the first one was obviously quite fortunate, I suppose. And the thing is with all these stories about air-to-air combat, and you'll get loads of them, Tim. You know, you meet people at air shows and they'll say, do you like Aircraft X? And I'll say, you know, not particularly. And so, well, I met a driver once who had gunned an F-15. Yeah. So, and what does that prove? So in that scenario, we had simply just once got under the wall of sweep aircraft that the coalition were throwing against us. I was playing Red Air. I was pretending to be a MiG. And someone had a bad day at the office, which meant that we got under the sweep, which meant that we got into the special mission aircraft. And the ones that we came across were EA-6Bs, which, if you've ever seen them, I horrible accident, obviously, but I'd never understood how one of them had managed to impact a cable car or the cables from a cable car and essentially come off best. And then you go to Nellis and I taxi past one of these damn things and they are absolutely huge. They look like they've been sort of hacked out of granite blocks as well. But anyway, got in behind those guys. And there was an element of just wanting to keep on shooting because you're having such a good time in the exercise. But secondly, I don't know if anyone's ever owned up to this as well. It's actually sometimes really hard to remember how many shots you've taken. So what Right. You don't want to do is come back to the debrief and say, hey, I was simulating these two types of Russian weapons. I had two of the first and four of the second. And then find out that you're claiming a seventh shot against the EA6. So actually, just to make sure, when you know, we'd done a lot of air-to-air, you know, simulated killing by then, it was really a case of, well, A, it's fun. B, you know, there's nothing better than going up to someone in the bar and saying, I didn't just kill you, I gunned you. And it makes great footage, obviously, for the gun tape. And there's the element of, well, you can't run away from this, mate. There isn't, you can't say you flared. You can't say you outmaneuvered me. That you're taking bullets through the aft cockpit type thing. So there we go. But I do have to foot stomp. That was someone who had a bad day. And I think from memory, Tim, it was it the second Thursday of a red flag? So, you know, you would still have to be alive on day eight the war against the USAF for that to happen. And that's quite a tall order, really. So, but it was good fun nonetheless. And you know what, the Blue Air guys were absolutely magnanimous in the debrief. I remember in particular one of the CF-18 drivers coming across and going, "You boys had a good day at the office." And going, "Yeah, we did." but that's all it was.
So you also had a control lock incident that sent you into the sort of possibly restricted airspace.
Yeah, exactly that. The Sea Harrier did have a bit of a habit of having control restrictions. Every now and again, you'd experience a little bit of problem with the primary flying control. So, and this could manifest itself, Tim, as essentially a notchiness. You know, something's not quite right. Bearing in mind that the Harrier and particularly the Sea Harrier always felt not quite right, in that occasionally, even on long transits, you'd be going, "Oh, is that normal? Is it doing something strange? Is it in some sort of Dutch roll or whatever?" But on this occasion, yeah, the stick genuinely just locked solid. And you know, luckily I was going away. Luckily I was had a bit of time on my hands. And essentially by luck, I missed the northwest corner of the restricted airspace up there, and then managed to work out exactly how I could control the aeroplane using speed, power, nozzle, and rudder, and the fact that just occasionally I could sort of get the stick to unlock in roll, and that made the difference between being able to recover the jet and not. And there is a bit of a drop short. That there's a airfield called Indian Springs just to the south of the red flag areas, and I managed to get the aircraft on the ground there. So some would say, Tim, that actually the aircraft was always going to fly there, and I just happened to be a voting member along for the ride. But I was able to sort of transcribe a long left turn out of the southwestern side of the red flag areas and make an approach into Indian Springs. So all's well that ends well, I guess we could say about that one.
So, gosh, yeah, I mean, there's enough hair-raising stories in there on the, obviously on the Sea Harrier, and then you transition to the GR9 and Naval Strike Wing Joint Force Harrier and operational flying in Afghanistan, providing close air support to coalition forces, dropping live weapons on insurgents, and again the sort of standout chapter for me was you know, flying in that steep valley and cloud, you know, which had my heart hot in my mouth reading it. Can you elaborate a bit more on that one?
Well, not all that much more elaboration required. But the point about Afghanistan for us fixed wing pilots is it's all about the ground commander, because we're only there to do a job, and it's whatever the ground commander wants, or the boys and girls on the ground. And let's be honest, I flew CAS missions in Afghanistan, but my boots never touched Afghanistan out of Kandahar. I was airborne in an air-conditioned cockpit. So, you know, hats off to those boys and girls who are the, you know, smelling things, seeing things, et cetera, that I'm not. And I think that's probably what leads you to that situation whereby, you know, golly, that the weather's scoshy. You know, you really shouldn't be that low in those sorts of weathers, et cetera. But you've got people on the ground genuinely fighting for their lives. So you sort of go, well, visors down, gum shield in, I am going to help. And that's what happened. I think the thing I like about that story, and I would share this with you, wouldn't I, Tim, is that when I shared the written version of that with the bloke whose wing I was on that day, he emailed me back and said, "I've got hair standing up on the back of my neck. This is exactly how I remember it." So that's a bit of a crossfix as to maybe a bit of validation about the story. But it's just what we did. And I would also say it's what any Harrier driver would have done. It's probably what any, you know, I can't speak for the wider communities. I'm not saying that the Harrier drivers are in any way special. It's just that I can only speak for my own community. I'm sure that any coalition fixed wing operator or air crew for the multi-crew guys would have done exactly the same. It's just that I was the one who got the call.
Yeah. Did you ever meet up with any of the troops or JTACs you provided air support for?
Yeah, indeed. So particularly the Brits used to come back through Kandahar for what I think was called a recock or something halfway through their tour. Or if they needed to come back, then they'd come into the operations room. And it was sort of semi-formal, Tim, in so much as we would then review the missions, review the tapes from either the sensors, the targeting pods or whatever. But actually, the most useful part of that was actually just having a tin of 7-Up with them on the sun deck and just chatting and getting to know them. Because, at the end of the day, it is a team game and they were the most important part of the team. So yes, absolutely. And for any of the other missions, then, as with all aviation, the important bit's the debrief, isn't it? Because that's the bit you learn. So we were always keen to reach back out to those, let's call them customer units, and make sure that we were giving them the service that they needed and deserved.
Yeah. What was your most memorable mission in Afghanistan then? Would that be it or were there any others?
For the right reasons, it was probably that one. I'm trying to think if there was one that was memorable for all the wrong reasons. But there was actually. Yes. The one that was memorable for all the wrong reasons was one where my friend and I decided to get back into Kandahar using a TACAN approach, and it turned out that the TACAN was broken, and we ended up essentially flying around in dust, thinking this isn't too bright. But luckily, we essentially were. What we're trying to do is we were trying to use the precision approach radar at Kandahar, but there was the equipment essentially kept failing. So we had to keep jumping between a precision approach and a non-precision approach. And just as we were saying, this is daft, and we're holding fuel to get to Bagram, then we should probably just go to Bagram and be done with it and just accept the fact that the jets wouldn't be ready for the next wave. And we'd have to ask someone else to cover our tasking, which is what the command and control guys did. Then we got our lucky break and the precision radar held up long enough for us to do an approach all the way in or whatever. But that was one of those times when you go, you know what, this has got to the point where professional judgment says, there is a time to press on with the mission. This is not it. Let's take the jets to Bagram and take stock there.
So, I mean, this is a bit of a frank question, so no obligation to answer it. But it's now been just over 1 year since the coalition pulled out from Afghanistan and left. What are your feelings on this?
I think that we're doing a really good job as a Western society, let's say, of glossing over what was a total and utter defeat, Tim. That is what a defeat looks like. 10 plus years, God knows how many pounds, God knows how many lives, dollars, to go from one state of affairs to a carbon copy of those state of affairs. So and I know people will criticize me for saying so, but it is just simply my own opinion that our involvement in Afghanistan, when you look at that final, let's call it dismal retreat from Afghanistan, has to be that we hold our hand up and say we were beaten. Full stop, end of story. And I know that there were great tactical victories on the ground. I know that every boy, girl, man, lady who went out there gave a great account of themselves. But strategically, we lost. We didn't stay the course.
Yeah.
Does that answer the question?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, my thought on that would be, following question is, do you think it encouraged Putin to think that the NATO West is a spent force, Ukraine's there for the taking. Why not, take a punt?
I don't think that that's a bad bit of logical thinking at all. To be honest, I think that there's a couple of things. The first is that the logic behind leaving Afghanistan was, well, we've got to get out of Afghanistan because we've got to concentrate on the Russia and Chinese threat. I think, broadly speaking. What the ridiculous part of that is that by leaving Afghanistan, you give those two countries levers to fill that vacuum. So So you sort of, it's a self-defeating theory in the first place. I think that it's more than plausible that Putin and his echo chamber of great ideas saw that as weakness and they are a spent force. However, there's also the other concept about the Russians, which is that you, on the one hand, they might want to say, we'll get away with this because NATO's a spent force. But on the other hand, they paradoxically hold up as one of their reasons for action the fact that NATO are potent and are knocking on their door and expanding. So there is a sort of paradox there that doesn't make sense to me.
Peter,
we went quite deep there, didn't we?
Yeah.
Event Fire Solutions is an independent fire and rescue service providing both preventative and reactive emergency services across the UK. As well as our main event management, we provide the support and equipment to deliver a safe and risk-free event. From fire appliances to medical vehicles, our fully trained and accredited staff will make your event a true success. If you need risk-related advice, investigation, medical or fire training, then we can deliver this for you. From the office to the airfield, we have the experience and the accreditation and most of all the skills to make your workplace event safe and risk-free. To find out more of how we can help you, look us up at eventfiresolutions.co.uk.
Peter, Ellie, you got any questions to throw in at this point? Or
yeah, I've got a couple of questions actually for Paul. We had Ian Sloan on the programme a short while ago, and Ian had also been on secondment on the Charles de Gaulle flying Super Anton Dard. And we talked a lot about the culture. I was just wondering what your view was the differences in the culture between the Royal Navy and the French Navy?
Yeah, it's a great question, Peter. So, and Larry, I knew Ian, or Larry as we used to call him, from Sea Harrier and Harrier. And
yes, he didn't tell us his name was Larry.
well, now you know. And indeed, it was actually a bit of staff work that this isn't particularly interesting that I did when I was on the Charles de Gaulle with their team. They were really keen when they heard that the Harrier was going out of service to find some way of essentially bringing expertise and helping us perpetuate skills, etc. And that resulted in that exchange that Larry then went on. So culturally, I think they were very closely aligned to the way I used to think. There were some really first class pilots and warriors in their air group. I think that the issue, and again, there's a massive paradox about to come up here, Peter, is when I sailed with the French, the Marine Nationale to Afghanistan, that there was this, I think there was this overall sense that they were power projecting into the Indian Ocean and were going to be seen to assist in Afghanistan. But there was something a little bit amiss. So if you looked at, for example, their rules of engagement, their intent and their procedures, I had misgivings that they were ever going to actually contribute meaningfully out there, which really frustrated their air group. That, you know, at the tactical level, they were absolutely aghast at some of the things that were going on. Forward wind a couple of months, I came back from that tour with the French and went straight out to Ellamy. And right next to us, I was in HMS Albion and HMS Ocean supporting the attack helicopters that you might have read about in books like the one by Will Laidlaw. I was on that warship. But the French were next to us in essentially the next lane, and we were cooperating with them. And they went into that fight like hounds unleashed, Peter. They really did. So it's quite strange to see that change. But I would, again, without wanting to repeat myself verbatim, at the tactical level, that's superb, boys and girls. Really, really great operators.
And he said the food was very good as well.
Ludicrously good. Genuinely ludicrously good. I was there over Christmas. And they did a brilliant job of bringing all the delights of France all the way to the India. God knows how they did it, but it was very good indeed from that perspective, whilst being slightly frustrated from an operational one.
The UK Harriers weren't there for Ellamy, and we decided to retire the Harriers early. So I think I know the answer to this, but was that the right choice?
Right, so the Harrier going out of service early. Yeah, I'm still a little bit angry about it, but there were decisions along the way that sort of made it easier. A good example would be the fact that the Royal Navy invested in the FA2 TIM when the YAV8B flew in 1981, for example. So we probably invested in a less future-proof design by re-radaring the FRS1 when we could have been thinking about the Harrier 2 Plus, which is obviously still in service today throughout a couple of Marine Corps, Spanish Navy, etc. So could it still be contributing? Yes. But the fact is that we had run out of money. I still think we could have maybe looked at a more imaginative solution to running out of money, maybe a reduced force with a reduced weapon carriage. I can't remember how many weapons we used to use in the Harrier force, but each of them obviously had a training bird. And if you had gone down to maybe just Paveway 4 carriage or CRB7, then that might have been worth investigating slightly further. But at the end of the day, you only save pennies by making fleets smaller, and we needed to save pounds, which meant getting rid of a fleet. And the judgment was that it came down to a two-horse race, didn't it, between, yeah, I believe, the Harrier and the Tornado. And so there are probably a vast majority of people listening to this going, dry your eyes, it made the right decision. I'm not sure that's entirely true. I think it was a lot closer than people might imagine, because the problem with aviation that you always get back to is it's not a game of top trumps. You know, yes, the Tornado can go faster on paper, but we had a better, at the time, Paveway forfeit, for example. And they would need a longer runway than us, and they can't be sea-based, etc. So everything's a compromise, and I personally wouldn't have made that decision, but I guess at some point you've got to stop blubbing. It's just that I haven't got to that point yet.
Okay. So after FA2, after GR9, then we come to exchange flying with the Super Hornet with the US Navy. So you are a massive fan of the Super Hornet. It comes across on Twitter, comes across in the book. Situation awareness, so much situation, you can bottle it and pass it on to passing aircraft. Why is that? What do you love about the Super Hornet? It's
an incredibly well put together aircraft. Now, again, everything's a compromise. Some people will be listening to this going, yeah, it's slow. But then again, you say, well, how many times do you actually genuinely go fast? So, for example, I think that because of one of the systems on board, Royal Air Force Typhoons are limited to Mach 1.8. Does that sound about right? Despite the fact that, you know, you'll be able to find a Wikipedia thing saying it can go Mach 2 plus. And, you know, I have seen Mach 1.4 in a Super Hornet, so maybe they're not that different. The thing about it, though, that was absolutely brilliant was the integration of everything. You're only a button press away from being in air-to-surface mode, one press away from the stores page, and then it really doesn't matter what weapon you're deploying, whether it's something really simple like a JDAM or a JSAO or a Harpoon, and. Just keep on going. You'll never pretty much run out of weapons that the aircraft can take. It's very well integrated and very simple to use. On the other side of things, that the Fusion, which I think that's as we grew up, Tim, what we always heard that the Typhoon was struggling with, was always perfect. So I flew on a squadron with the APG-79, which is an AESA, which is just the all-seeing eye, but everything was always correlated perfectly. The radar hit, the link track, and other things that you could find out about the threat aircraft using the systems was always absolutely in sync. And they seem to be, again, you know, carved out of hills. I saw a Super Hornet have an a Growler, so a EA-18G, have an in-flight engagement during one of my carrier periods, which means basically that the jets in full afterburn are trying to pull an aircraft carrier along, and at some point it's going to lose. And this thing came down on the deck, genuinely, it looked like a dropped sandbag, and then went into sort of a wet Labrador shake as all the flight controls went a little bit doolally. Didn't even register a heavy landing. It was just one of the most amazing things I've ever seen, and the jet just walked it off. So it was just a superbly put together aircraft. Obviously, the F-15 is going to be able to go quicker, so the Typhoon, etc. But you know, for an aircraft that where it is now. You've got fabulous data link, helmet mounted sight that works every time, tote decoy, jammer, etc. Just a brilliant aircraft. But again, go back to a point I've made a couple of times now. Others will disagree, but everything's a compromise.
And having done both, how do you rate VSTOL versus conventional carrier ops? You know, in terms of the stress of landing, you know, getting back and trapping. John Farley, famously says it's easier to stop and land than land and stop. Was that your view?
Well, I've been told I'm mad for thinking what I do think, but this is how I think. I think that John Farley, and I, obviously it's definitely not my place to disagree with the great man, was probably right about daytime operations. I think that the VSTOL approach and landing is the easiest to do well at. I think that I used to find the night trap the easiest because essentially it's an instrument approach and you fly the ball to touchdown. And there's only three things that you need to see, Tim, and that, you know, meat ball, lineup, angle of attack. And at night, they were the only three things I could see. Now, I can understand why people could consider that to be quite disconcerting because essentially what you're trying to do is fly into the sea and hope that an aircraft carrier gets in the way. I found that quite straightforward. But then maybe I was lucky because I'd flown night VSTOL. I found night VSTOL quite tense, to be honest, because you're flying into the darkness beside the sea. And then once you've established a decent hover alongside a boy or girl waving a wand at you, which is essentially a torch with a cone on the end, that's when you go across the deck to land on. So I found night VSTOL by a country mile the hardest to do, and day cat and trap I also found relatively tricky, only because there's so many darned procedures. By the time I got round the back to fly the ball, I was sort of wrung out by all the stuff you needed to do to get there, which you just didn't bother with at night. So probably a bit of a non-traditional way of grading them.
So my all my night traps, day traps are obviously in Flight Simulator rather than the real thing. But night landings being the easier. Ellie, you're the real pilot in the room here as well. Does that sound completely mad to you?
Well, I haven't done a night rating, so yeah, it sounds completely bonkers, but it sounds really
good. Oh, you should. So carrier ops, Ellie, are the sports of kings. It really is. The notion, and we would say this, wouldn't we, because it makes us unique, that the fact that the land-based guys are essentially switching off and going home to a well-lit aerodrome while we're trying to find a bit of tarmac in the middle of the sea is what sets us apart. And it's what makes it good fun. You know, that's why everyone wanted to be on the teams that embarked, disembarked, etc., because that's where the good fun was as well. So, I heartily recommend it.
And talking of the sort of sport of kings, which... dogfighting, air-to-air, ACM is often described as, versus mud moving. You've done both in two variants of the Harrier, and the Super Hornet can do both as well. Which do you prefer and why?
I think it has to be the air-to-air fight. And I'll come back to the air-to-air fight in that, obviously there's nothing wrong with mud moving, Tim, but essentially you're fighting against a stopwatch, the weather, and maybe surface-to-air operators, et cetera, in its raw terms. And I know I'm being incredibly flippant there. But in the air-to-air world, and you know what, guess what, mud movers do actually have to fight their way through air-to-air caps, et cetera, you're fighting against fighter pilots. And that's what makes it a challenge for me. You know, if you are just in inverted commas, trying to fly around, for example, Wales, and your job is to get a bomb on a target on time, then... that's going to be a relative, from a philosophical point of view, a relatively straightforward mission. And you're either going to do it or you're not. Whereas if it's you and me sat 1.5 miles apart in any type of jet, you know, a Hawk or anything upwards, it'll be, okay, then Tim, let's see what you got. Let's have some rough and tumble and sort this out. So that's why I enjoyed the air-to-air bit.
Cool. So talking of rough and tumble and, seeing what you've got, you must have seen Top Gun Maverick this year, and how many times?
I've seen it once, but compared to the rest of my family, that's incredibly low.
And Forts, how many stars does it get? And can you really pull 10G in a Super Hornet and the wings stay on?
Well, and with my miserable G tolerance, Tim, I'd probably never have made it myself, to be honest. The jet was far harder than I was. The way I would describe it is, isn't it majestic? It's just superb, isn't it? Right from that opening scene where you get the Mac whatever it is, 10 beast that apparently can fall apart around you and you'll be fine type thing. That sort of shot that's from space is just superb.
Yeah.
And you can either sit around watching these films going, well, he's going to have an interesting time in the debrief. That would never happen. Why are they in that formation? Or you can just sort of rejoice in the air-to-air footage and the form. You know, when you look, for example, at the F-18s coming through the valley, that they got those lovely shots of the vapor coming off the upper surfaces of the aerodynamic surfaces. You can either look at that and go, why are they in that formation? That's the most ridiculous tactical formation ever. Or you can say, that's awesome. That is a spectacle and I'm enjoying myself. So I really, really enjoyed it. And I'm sure that no one involved in the film would ever tell me how to fly an airplane. So I'm never going to tell them how to make a film, if that makes sense.
Brilliant. And obviously in the film as well, there was a glimpse at the start, but the F-35 kind of, didn't really, kind of make an appearance. GPS jamming was the excuse. Where do you personally sit on the F-35B debate? And worthy success as the Harrier or expensive piece of junk?
Oh, golly, there's lots to discuss here. Firstly, the first thing to say, Tim, is that of every single second in either Top Gun movies, the real deck ops are the highlights for me. And that's, you don't need to embellish anything when you've got those real deck ops at the start, which is when I think you see the F-35 Charlie model in the current movie. That even now puts the hairs on my arms and necks on end, knowing that boys and girls are taxiing to the catapults. It's just awesome. So there's that. Again, going back to previous point about does it make sense in the movie, quite why their fifth-gen jets can't fly, but they're scared of the enemy fifth-gen jets, I don't really understand, but never mind, go with it. That's just the story. The F-35 itself, I'm very clear about this, there are only two types of Air Force in the world at the moment, those with F-35 and those without. Full stop. If there are very, very few machines in history that can honestly say they were game changers. There are loads we love, for example, the Spitfire, etc., but did it change the game? And the answer is no, we just did better stuff with it or did the same things better. The F-35 is a game changer. There's a debate to be had about the variant, because the laws of physics do actually catch up with you at some point. Do you want more fuel? Do you want more weapons? Or do you want a lift fan? That jury will be out for quite a while. And I get the training side of things, and I get the whole fleet support side of things, and I get the carrier needing wires, et cetera, et cetera. But I am a fan. Should we summarize with I am a fan?
Yeah, that sounds good. So, Peter, Ellie, have you got any more questions?
Yeah, I've got lots of questions I'd like to ask you, Paul, about carrier ops. But given all the aircraft that we've already described in your logbook, do you miss flying any of these?
I think I do. I didn't initially. Maybe I was a bit worn out with it. Maybe I was a bit jaded with being in the military, et cetera, et cetera. So I didn't initially. But yes, I do. But I'm very, very conscious, Peter, of the fact that it's a young person's game. And flying fast jets, in a way, is a bit like sitting in a high-performance tumble dryer and getting beaten up most days. So I think that as humans, we tend to miss things, but we tend to forget that actually it was great while it lasted and wouldn't necessarily be great again now. Now, having said that, I know of a few of my contemporaries who, as reservists, et cetera, have gone back to fly Typhoon. So, there are folk who still go and do it with the Royal Air Force and are obviously doing a fabulous, fabulous job. So the answer is yes, a little bit. I think in my as the time from getting out of the jets lengthens slightly, I have begun to miss it more.
And would you fly general aviation at maybe sometime in the future?
Yeah, Peter, I'd love to. I even got as far as to go back up to the aerodrome that's quite close to me to say to the instructors there, hey, this isn't supposed to sound stupid, but I'm an ex-military pilot. Here are my logbooks, which, bearing in mind, I've got the Flying Scholarship logbook, the UAS logbook, my Royal Navy one, my US Navy one, etc. How do I become one of you? And we settled upon the fact that, and this was my idea rather than theirs, they were very forward leaning with the just come and do a skills check, I think it was called. But the my view was I needed to pay for a course of lessons to find out where the gaps were so that I could, you know, progress to a skills check relatively rapidly. But life just keeps getting in the way. And finding a spare weekend or a spare weekend and a month with the money for Avgas at the end of it, then it just hasn't happened. But that's probably just me making excuses. Woeful admin.
We're going to have to get Ellie to take you up when she's doing aerobatics next.
Well, particularly if she's got the services of a U2, that would be fabulous.
I haven't quite got there yet, I wish, but you definitely need to come fly.
And Ellie, what did you do your aerobatics in?
Super Decathlon. It was James Maisel aircraft, hence the awesome registration.
Paul, one final question then. I know Tim wanted to ask this one, so I'm going to jump in here with it very quickly. Was there any aircraft that you never got to fly or that you'd love to fly that you haven't?
This is actually a very easy answer for me, Peter. And the answer is the F4U Corsair. That's the only one that I've ever wanted to fly.
Wow, didn't expect that one.
And that's because, in my opinion, it was everything you'd want in a fighter. It was super powerful, super manoeuvrable, super fast. We took it to the deck successfully. It could do, again, I'm probably going to court controversy here, it could do anything that any of its contemporaries could. Some of the performance for the F4U was just staggering for its time frame. And if that gull wing doesn't float your boat, then there's something wrong with you. It just looks the business.
And I knew you had a little soft spot for the Viggen as well.
The Viggen was definitely my favourite aircraft when I was growing up for a little while, based on, because I, like a lot of other folk, was a very amateur airfix modeller. And I was particularly fascinated by the Swedish camouflage. I just thought that looked superb. And actually, you know, I was looking at a picture of a Draken only today. That the Saab line is just good looking, isn't it?
Oh, Tim, and you were there a few weeks ago, weren't you, Tim?
Yeah, I was at Uppsala, looking at Viggens and Drakens and all things Swedish. So yeah, no, great to see a Viggen in the air. But funnily enough, on the Corsair, that's another aviation film coming this year.
Oh, is it?
Devotion.
I've got a cap somewhere that someone in the Swedish Air Force gave me that very kindly, because I did an exercise with them out in the north of their country just about the time that the Viggen was going out of service. And I'll get this wrong, but it's a lovely baseball cap and it's got something like Saab Viggen, you will never be forgotten. But it's got two or three really bad spelling mistakes in there, so I've never worn it.
Understood. That's me done, Tim. Thanks.
All right. So I think we're coming to the coming up to of our allotted time. So last few questions really, I suppose, are kind of about the book itself and response and are there other books planned? One thing, obviously, who hasn't read it, the footnotes are a real treat. I mean, were they your idea or did some editor say, you know, you're going to have to explain this technical stuff, and you thought, oh, I can have a bit of fun here?
No, completely my idea, and essentially that grew out of my background as a staff officer, because in amongst all the fun, I did three tours on desks somewhere or other, Tim, where that is how you write briefing documents, etc., to keep the subject matter pithy for seniors to understand quickly, with detail down in footnotes. So that was just how I did. And then, of course, if you're actually sort of verbally telling stories, you tend to go into unrelated, let's call them, oxbow lakes or whatever along the way. So hence I thought that was the way of characterizing it. In fact, the publisher, the first time they saw it, said, oh, we've not seen that before. Although moving on to the feedback point, one of my first really bad reviews was, a skillful writer would have managed to do this without footnotes. So Yeah. And reviews are a funny thing, aren't they? I'm new to this game, and I know you can't tell this because the videos are off, but I am smiling as I say this. I actually delight in the bad reviews because there's not everyone's going to get it. And if I, the way I reconcile it with myself, Tim, is that if I wrote a book that everyone got, everyone understood, everyone liked, well, I probably wasn't being honest enough then, and I probably wasn't being frank enough about my experiences, etc. On the other side of the coin, you know, I've had feedback either personally, sort of email, text, or on Twitter or LinkedIn from genuinely everyone I really care about. So still serving senior officers, Royal Air Force officers, at the sort of 2-3 star level, that I really genuinely value their opinion. My cousin, who is actually one of life's heroes, quite a girl with the French Air Force and DFC with the Royal Air Force, and my uncle, who was a Royal Air Force hunter and Phantom pilot, if they say it's good, then that'll do me, and we'll just have to have a beer in the bar with some of the folk who haven't liked it, shall we say.
Prowler crews and Tornado F crew, free crews then, presumably.
Well, bizarrely, Tim, you say that. I have got, and there's no need to, you'll just have to take my word for it. I've got emails from really super blokes who I've always liked and always enjoyed within certain communities. Maybe you've just mentioned one of those, going, oh, golly, I think we were a bit like that, weren't we, type thing, or, you know, good dits. And the thing to understand, of course, is that there was an intense rivalry that bubbled over very, and still does, between communities in military aviation. But that doesn't mean you wouldn't have fought like caged cats for each other if we'd ever had to go into battle together. It's just that, you know, it's a function of A, you're a bit competitive, B, neither of your machines is the best in the world, so you're trying to do the best you can. There's always competition for funding, for best exercise plot, etc., etc. So it's any wonder we're competitive. But at the end of the day, we're all on the same team.
No, I mean, I love the fact that it's a brutally honest book, you know, in that you know, kind of you know, into sort of a crew room banter that, you know, takes no prisoners. And it comes to me, reminds me of a quote from Derek Robinson's Piece of Cake, you know, up there are bastards or suckers, you know, make your choice. which is really great. It's refreshing. So is there going to be a sequel? Are there more books inbound? Fiction, historical stuff? Are you going to be writing some more?
I don't think, definitely not the last two you just spoke about. And the thing that I go back to when I'm asked this question, Tim, is I wrote that book when I was out of area with the French in 2010. So I just stopped being the senior pilot of the Naval Strike Wing. Everything was really fresh in my mind. I just got back from Afghanistan, so I was desperate to tell people the stories. We then got the kick in the face of the Harrier going out of service, which obviously came after the kick in the teeth of the F-82 going out of service. So that lent itself to a motivation, shall we say, and a way of sort of two-finger thumping away at a keyboard at night, which I don't know if I could replicate right now. I think if I did go back, I would probably just start with the, let's call them the 8 stories that I could find the titles of the stories, but I could find nowhere on any hard drive or any email where this thing had languished, the words I wrote about them. To give you a teaser, for example, that the day we all lied about our fuel to the tanker, which didn't go down very well, but the fuel liars was one of the chapters I simply couldn't find, which was a bit annoying.
And for our listeners, sort of Ellie's age or younger, who might read, you know, Harrier, what are your tips on becoming a fighter pilot, achieving your dream? You know, competition these days is fierce, intense. We've got a smaller Air Force, a smaller Navy. What would you suggest for applicants to sort of stand out, apart from writing a book?
The only tip I've got for... I've got context and a tip, Tim. The context is, it is easily the best job in the world, ever. Full stop, end of story. And that you will go and do things that you would just, if you can imagine trying to explain to your grandma what you've just done, if you've been on ops in Afghanistan or landed on a boat or fought a night mission in the North Sea, you're just not going to be able to do it. So that's the context. The only tip I have for all players is just keep going. Never, ever give up. I don't say this for effect. I genuinely don't believe that there was anything special inside me. I just refused to give up. And I had this inkling, this sort of shadow specter, call it what you will, all the way through flying training that I wasn't going to make it, but I had a dream to be a Sea Harrier pilot. And I made it my business every day to get up and see if I could get to that evening without getting chopped, essentially. And you know what? You stick enough of those days end to end and eventually you make it. So it really is a case of not being pig-headed about it and not being arrogant or anything like that, but just simply, whereas people start to fall by the wayside, be it an aptitude test, be it an interview, you know, maybe it's because of a relationship or they you know, the fire just dies or whatever, just make it your business to be the one who keeps going and you'll get there.
Brilliant. Okay, well, I think we're coming up to the time. Peter, have you got, or Ellie, have you got any more questions?
But what we'd really like to know is where we can get a copy of the book. The
book is available online, so Amazon, Harrier, How to Be a Fighter Pilot, will lead you straight to the book. If you, however, Peter, want to, any sort of personalization or a signature or whatever, I've got an agreement with the Marlowe Bookshop that they'll drop me a line if anyone orders through their website, and I can go down and, you know, sign it, dedicate it to anyone, or write my own message or whatever in it, just because that's the most appropriate and easy thing for me to do. So really easy to get hold of. But if you do want the personalization, if you just go through the Marlowe Bookshop, which again reacts really well to a Google, then that's the easiest way to do it.
And we'll put a link to that in the show notes. Finally, Paul, then, where can we find you online?
Oh, I'm really badly disguised as Paul_Tremelling on Twitter. So it's not a brilliant hiding place, is it? And that's pretty much me as far as an online presence goes, Peter.
No, I think that's me done. Just like to thank you, Paul, for your honesty, not only in the book, but here on the programme as well. And thank you very much for your time.
My absolute pleasure.
Yeah, it's been really great to get you on the show. I could keep going for hours
it'd be,
and hours.
It'd be great, and thank you so much for setting aside your time. Really, really great to talk to you guys. I'm expecting at least call about that.
Great, great to have you on the show at last. And we must get you back in the future.
She's got your details now, Paul. If you'd like to support the program, we welcome listener donations. If you want to make a regular or one-off donation, and please, only if you can afford to do this, then see the donate button on our website. If you can't or don't want to donate, but want to show your appreciation for the work we do, please leave us a review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or on your podcast player. Or you can always buy your Amazon shopping through the link on our website. Just one click, it's as quick as that. Remember, please to follow Event Fire Solutions on Twitter at EMFS999. And a big thank you to Mick and the Aviation Historian team for their ongoing support for Extended. Ellie, where can we find you online?
So I'm on Twitter. My handle is @DragonGirl94, I think. And I'm on Instagram, and that's EllieCarter74.
Tim, where can we find you online?
Sure. I'm tweeting bad aeroplane puns and aviation news at RES at Tim R. And you can find the Royal Aeronautical Society, www.aerosociety.com.
You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter. And you can find Gareth at Gareth_Stringer on Twitter as well. You can, of course, find Extended on our Twitter, Facebook and Instagram feeds. And that's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Paul.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Ellie.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Tim.
Goodbye all. See you next time.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The program's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our program and broaden its reach. You can also review the program and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of Extended.
Extended.
This is XTP Media.